Welcome to the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Catherine Iden, filling in for Steve Junker. This is our weekly News Roundup, where we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with my colleagues from the print and digital media. Joining me here in studio this morning, Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Thanks for coming in today.
You're welcome.
This hour, we will also hear from Brittany Bowker from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner, and we'll check in with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and our own WCAI climate environment reporter, Eve Zukoff. Jeff, let's take a look at some of the top stories this week. I want to start with one, a well-known horse farm in Falmouth where there are allegations of animal cruelty and an investigation ongoing.
Yeah, Catherine, this is a disturbing story, as you mentioned, out of Falmouth. It's Smithfield Farm, which is a farm on Sandwich Road in East Falmouth. It's under investigation by the Massachusetts Society for Prevention to Cruelty of Animals after they received several complaints about emaciated animals at the farm. The farm is where horses are boarded. They offer lessons, and they also sell horses. And the animal cruelty investigation was opened on Tuesday when the MSPCA did come down here to visit. The investigation will include an interview with the owner as well as some of the folks who filed the complaints. And we'll know very soon whether or not they're going to determine whether or not sufficient evidence is there to bring animal cruelty charges. But just for a little bit of background as to what happened here, there have been several complaints. Recently, there's been many Facebook posts with photos of these emaciated animals. And one of the persons who filed the complaint said for about a year there have been some issues there. And this isn't pretty, but she had said last month people were seeing horses lying dead, goats lying dead, paddocks were leaking, horses were sitting in the standing in the mud with no food or water. So you can imagine how horrible that was. Another person who filed a complaint says there were holes in the roof, frequent flooding in the barns, infested with rats, and every inch was covered by mold and rot. Mm. And just last month, the horses were involved, and the owner is involved with a therapeutic program. And there was a disabled man who was riding one of the horses at an event in Yarmouth. And this particular person said there was a big saddle, which kind of appeared weird, but it apparently was on there to cover the horse and his appearance, underweight and emaciated. And the horse went down with the man on him. So
not good.
Not good at all. And according to a spokesman from the MSPCA, it didn't appear as if there any of the horses were taken away from the property on Tuesday. We'll learn more about that in the coming days. And it just happens there's no boarding facilities available here in the Cape. They would have to go up to Methuen, which is almost on the New Hampshire border.
Right. And I think what was interesting, too, about this is the MSPCA does do these animal cruelty investigations, but they don't do a ton of them. They really, I think, have to pick what seem to be, I'm guessing, the most egregious because they get, you know, 1,500 or so complaints every year, but they can only do
25.
Yeah.
25. So they really have to be, as you said, really egregious.
And this was one of them.
And the owner is a woman named, I believe, Ms. Janice Foster. Mm-hmm. If found guilty, it's a felony in Massachusetts. You can spend up to 7 years in prison and a fine up to $5,000.
Right. So we'll be following that story.
Yeah, we will.
I want to go to a story out of Sandwich, and actually this is kind of a story that's evolving, and that's due to oysters being stolen, and this has happened in other towns recently as well.
It has, and you know, if there's ever a Cape Cod mystery, this is one of them.
Yeah.
About 4,000 oysters, not fully grown, immature oysters, I call them, were stolen from Mill Creek, which is near the Sandwich Boardwalk, and this happened 2 weeks ago, I believe 2 weeks ago today. And the town has been cultivating the shellfish, as many towns have, not only to help clean the waters, but is also to have a stock for licensed shellfishermen to harvest.
We call it a put and take. They put them there, but then you can take them if you have a license,
that's right?
Right.
Yeah. That's right. And they do take about 2 to 3 years to mature as they cultivate them. And actually, Sandwich, as part of its agriculture program, has about 100,000 oyster seeds per year. But what's odd about this, Catherine, is none of the oysters that were stolen are of legal size, so they couldn't sell them. And one of the quotes from the director of natural resources in town, which I thought was interesting, said, if somebody thought they were going to have a picnic, well, there's not enough meat in the shells.
Yeah, these are too little.
Why do you have them? You know, or somebody just probably didn't know.
And they're not edible either because they're possibly contaminated,
They are.
Right?
They were taken from water that is considered unsafe for harvesting because of high levels of fecal coliform bacteria. So that just adds to the mystery. They're too small. They're in a place where you really want to get oysters for consumption.
Right.
So the Mass Environmental Police are investigating this case. And as a result of this theft, there may not be a harvest this year for recreational shellfish, people with licenses in Sandwich. And now that because of the theft, there are cameras and lights to monitor where they are in the creek.
Wow. So, and the town of Sandwich has been working for a long time to get this shellfish bed installed, as you said, for both the water cleaning properties, but also to have this area for local shellfishermen to get these locally grown shellfish. And so this really is a blow to that project.
It is. And you know, I live in Mashpee, and I've been doing it for several years, and it's a big event. I mean, people look forward to it.
Yeah,
so it's
unfortunate. It's a lot of fun. And there have been, there's been other reports of other towns having similar problems as far out as on the Outer Cape in Wellfleet, Barnstable in Mashpee.
Exactly.
There's been problem with
there
thefts as well. And these oysters they're not in the sand yet. They're in these floating cages. So they're, I guess in a sense, they are accessible if you are of a mind to break the law.
Right, right.
But, you know, it will be interesting. I thought it was interesting, too, heard reports that in Sandwich, the Natural Resources Department was saying, listen, if you bring these oysters back, we'll say no questions asked.
Exactly.
Get them out of potentially the market where they could hurt somebody. I mean, if you eat a contaminated shellfish, you could get very ill. You could even die.
Right. And there was a case very similar to that in Falmouth, I believe, last year, where some were sold.
Right. And, we've had reports of this around the Cape over the last few years. But no leads.
Nobody's come forward. No leads as of right now. But we're going to continue to follow up on that.
All right. That's oysters being stolen in Sandwich.
Yeah.
I want to turn now. We are right on the cusp of this back-to-school season. And school bus drivers had a little lesson of their own the other day, and that's about vaping and how to identify it with teens and then and kids of all ages, actually,
all
and
ages.
What to do about it.
That's right. I've been covering this for quite a bit lately. I also cover the town of Barnstable, which has become a big issue there. But the use of vaping products, which includes a lot of flavored products. Juul is the most popular vaping device.
It's like the brand name.
It's been declared an epidemic among youth. Becoming a major problem here in the United States and elsewhere, I would imagine. So the Barnstable County Department of Human Services has said, and these are some staggering statistics, from 2017 to 2018, just 1 year, they've seen an increase in youth vaping, 50% in middle school ages. Now, I guess that's what could be 12.
I know. I'm thinking, how young is a middle schooler by these standards? 11, 12?
Right.
Really young.
And an 80% increase in high school students. Which to me was just, oh my gosh, wow. So the Department of Health of Human Services of the county on Wednesday had a program for about 250 bus drivers, which I thought was very interesting because they actually are on the front lines of seeing what these children are doing.
They really are.
And just to educate them a little bit about the youth vaping problem, what are some of the trends and how to spot them. So if you're driving the bus and you have a bus full of kids on the way to school and you think something's happening, you can alert the school officials. And the county is actually, as the beginning of the school year, which as mentioned starts next week in most places, they're kicking off a new campaign called Escape the Vape, where this county department has developed a toolkit for after the schools reached out and said, hey, how can you help us with this? So the executive director of this organization did present to the bus drivers and the Cape Cod Collaborative, which responsible for a lot of student transportation, said, we want to make sure that our drivers are informed about this and what they need to look for. And some of this really is incredible, Catherine.
Well, it's not – and that's the thing, too. It's not at all like cigarettes where it's really – the smell. It's very obvious. It's a specific type of, you know, the visual is there. I mean, there's two things going on here, which is what I gleaned from the article in the Times, and that is Vape pens are easy to kind of disguise. Mm-hmm. And then the side effects, we're learning more and more about what the side effects are. Tell us more about what the vape pens can look like and how they can be hard to spot.
Well, first of all, they told the bus drivers, hey, look for puffs of vapor if you can, and look at the tapes, and then you can alert staff. Mm. But some of the accessories in the vape pens, they look like USB devices. Some maybe like a small tape recorder. But what I found very interesting here is that there are some clothing and backpacks that are designed
for
to
vaping.
Hide this. Yeah. Yeah. One of them is a hoodie that said they look like a normal hoodie, but the strings use as tubes to smoke. I haven't seen one, but I'll look now.
Yeah, and it will make you look twice, you know, at kids who maybe chew on their mm-hmm. clothes a little bit, as kids sometimes do. It's going to make you take a second look.
That's right. And they also say if you smell something sweet, that's a sign as well. The flavored tobacco products are the ones that are really popular among that age group. Watermelon, mango. There are actually thousands of flavors. And the town of Barnstable, actually, on July 29th, has new regulations where flavored tobacco products cannot be sold in any store that allows 21 years old or under to come in. It's been quite a big story there in Barnstable. And in each Juul flavor pod, which is a little thing you put in your little vaping device, has the same amount of nicotine as in a full pack of cigarettes. And wow. Some of these kids, Catherine, are going through them in a half hour.
And that's causing problems, right?
Major health problems. A lot of them, you know, because this is so new, we won't know the full extent of this for several years. But they're telling parents to also keep an eye out. Some of the things you may notice if your child is using these vaping devices is nosebleeds. They may want less caffeine. I don't know what... If kids that age drink coffee, I guess it's the soda and Red Bull and all that, because they already feel as if they're energized enough and have a fast heartbeat. And also, they tend to add more seasoning to foods because this vaping on a regular basis tends to stunt your sense of taste.
And I wonder if that's permanent. No, do we know?
Don't know.
We don't know yet.
Don't know.
And there's more serious problems that can happen too. Lung problems they're finding
popcorn
now.
Popcorn lung is something that happens, yeah.
So definitely an important kind of lesson for bus drivers, as you said, who are on the front lines to maybe spot some of this behavior and then help parents and teachers and students understand maybe the risks of what they're doing.
This is a real emerging health issue here.
I want to turn now to a kind of a transportation story, and that's out of Bourne. And Bourne joined the MBTA a few years ago, and that's because there's this hope that the commuter rail will come to the Cape. But we're not exactly any closer to seeing that as a reality. And there's a lot of money in cost to being a member of the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority.
Yeah, you think of members of the MBTA, you think of Metro West, Quincy, you know, places closer to the city. But in 2014, in hopes that commuter rail would come to the tracks, which are already in place, coming to Buzzards Bay, the Cape Flyer operates on them, would somehow revitalize commuter rail coming to Bourne and really providing a big boost to the village of Buzzards Bay and maybe generate some transit-oriented development, which is very popular these days. You see these mixed-use communities springing up around transit stations.
Mm-hmm.
And they took the chance. They joined back in 2014. But as you had mentioned, it really hasn't moved forward yet, but there's still hope.
Yeah.
4 years later, there's still no service, but the town officials say, hey, you know what? Joining that was the right thing to do. Gives us a seat at the table as plans are being developed. And with the advent of the new South Coast Rail Project, there is a chance that something could happen there with a link. In 2014, when this was signed, it was right before a lot of MBTA problems started emerging. That winter of 2015, which, remember, it never stopped snowing.
Yes.
That was a problem. And up until right now, with all the derailments, et cetera, et cetera. So the hope is that this service can be restored, possibly as part of the South Coast Rail Project, with a connector train, which would go from Buzzards Bay to Middleborough, which seems to be the hub that's developing for South Coast Rail, which would allow commuters then to transfer the train to South Station.
Right. So it is that piece, at least, is a little more of a possibility than in the meantime. Bourne officials did say to the paper that they're happy that they're part of the group. They're paying $40,000
a year
for this, but that they say it's worth every penny because they want to be able to advocate to get that train
stopped.
And
they say, you know, we didn't expect it to happen overnight, so it's going to take a while.
So it's a long-term planning.
It's well worth the investment.
That's right. And that is Jeff Spillane of the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, Thank you so much for talking about some of the top news stories of the week. We need to take a break. Stay with us. We have more top stories from around the region to come. Welcome back to the Point News Roundup. I'm Catherine Iden, filling in for Steve Junker. And we're going to take a look now at some other news from around the region. I want to start with some news from Martha's Vineyard. Bill Ewell of the Vineyard Gazette joins us now on the phone. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us today.
Of course.
So the start of school is right around the corner. We were just talking about another school-related story, but it looks like some students in Tisbury are getting an extension on the summer, and not necessarily for great reasons. It's because there's some chipping lead paint and other issues inside the school.
Yeah, this was a real surprise about, you know, just a little over a week before school was to begin. At a meeting on Wednesday, just 2 days ago, it was announced that the students from the Tisbury School will have to be relocated indefinitely, and the start of school delayed at least a week due to the chipping lead paint issue that was recently found. Now, the Tisbury School is one of five grammar schools on the island, and it has about 300 students in K through 8th grade, so it's a lot of people affected, students, teachers, parents, all really scrambling, you know, sort of in the last minute.
Yeah, that is a lot of people. Do officials have a plan? Such a last minute. Obviously, they felt that it was such a health advisory or health issue that students couldn't go to school there. But where are those kids going to go now?
It's a good question. They do have a plan, an intermediary plan. They are going to start a week late so teachers can get these other classrooms set up. And the classrooms are going to, the way they're going to do it is split up. K through 4 is going to go to the campus at Camp Jabberwocky, which is also in Tisbury. The students in grades 5 through 8 will go to the high school, so they're getting those places organized to, you know, take in a lot more students. So that's the deal. That's why they're delaying it a week. Now, the school was built in 1929 and has been for a long time, as you can imagine, in serious state of disrepair. 2 years ago, there was a big close vote to build a new school, and it actually passed a town meeting, but then later failed at the ballot box. So since then, the big question is, okay, how do we shore up this ailing school? And that's what prompted a lot of this testing this summer. They tested for asbestos, and they also tested for lead paint. Asbestos was cleared, but as I said, the lead paint, they found out on Tuesday testing was an issue, and that's when officials started to scramble to try to figure out temporary measures while they do the remediation and, you know, fix the situation.
Right. Do they have any idea of how long it's going to take? I mean, are the students going to be going to these other temporary locations for a good chunk of the fall?
That is a good question. as of now, we don't have answers to those. They don't know how long it will take. They don't, you know, completely know how the classes will work because, you know, again, the high school is also, you know, very crowded, and they're going to be talking about their own issues next week about how to maybe build a new high school and deal with that. So how it works is also going to be a big issue. And then, of course, there's what are working parents going to do who thought, you know, their kids were going to be headed back to school on September 3rd, now won't even be headed back till September 9th. And then there's the chaos of how the whole thing will work. So a lot of people are, you know, they're upset, obviously. Some are taking, you know, many are taking stride. But the big question is, why did it have to wait till the week before school? Couldn't the testing have been done earlier? Mm-hmm. Couldn't have, you know, some of these questions been put out there a lot earlier, so there could be more time to find answers.
Yeah, and I imagine some students, too, with this uncertainty, it might be a little bit trickier to go to school, a little more anxiety for students.
Yeah, can you imagine a kindergartner? Oh,
I know. It's such a big, important day. Yeah, it's an important day for every student. Yeah,
every student, but I'm really thinking about the little ones especially because, you know, changes can be scary. So, but the island is pulling together. As I said, the high school is taking a bunch, and then Camp Jabberwocky is not far from the school, but it really is an unfolding issue that we will, first on what to do with the lead paint, and then, of course, how the school will be fixed, repaired, what the status is going to be on that is going to be a long story.
It will be, and we'll be checking back in to hear updates on that. That's Bill Ewell, editor at the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks so much for checking in with this story.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
I want to hop on over to Nantucket now, where we'll hear some news from Josh Balling. He's with the Enquirer and Mirror. Josh, good morning. Josh, I want to talk first. Some neighbors along the waterfront aren't too happy about a smell. It smells like sulfur, and it's coming from some flooding.
It does. There's a sulfurous smell that's been wafting over Brant Point on the waterfront just at outside downtown much of the summer. It's apparently coming from a faulty pump station at Children's Beach, which is backing up salt water into a freshwater marsh owned by the Nantucket Conservation Foundation in the middle of this neighborhood through a single storm drain on high tides. It's also flooding into the surrounding streets, and a group of neighbors from the Brant Point Association have taken issue with what they say is a lack of maintenance by the town in this neighborhood made up of mostly summer residents in addressing the problem. They say they represent about 11% of the town's tax base and get less than 1% of the direct services, including maintenance and repair of this issue. The flooding has gotten worse this summer, they said, after the DPW removed a temporary pump it had installed at Children's Beach last fall, 9 years after this original pump started showing signs of failure, they said. But that pump came out for a reason, the DPW director said. It had been set up on the beach itself with a pipe running down the beach to an outfall into the harbor near Nantucket Yacht Club. But that exposed pipe could pose health and accessibility issues, the DPW director said, so it had to come out. And town officials also say that fixing the permanent pump is not necessarily easy. It's going to cost more than they have on hand to do that right now, so they're going to have to seek some more funding at next April's annual town meeting. It needs a whole new design, and new equipment needs to be installed. But in the meantime, the plan is to reinstall a temporary pump there this fall to alleviate some of the flooding. Typically, there's more flooding, more rain, more storms in the fall than there is in the summer. This particular property has never really flooded before in the summer when it's been drier out, the neighbors and the Conservation Foundation says, and they really want this addressed as soon as they can.
Yeah, it sounds like it's making it tough to live around that region, but it also sounds like it's a complicated fix that they're going to have to make. It's not going to be fixed overnight.
It doesn't sound like it, no.
And we've had, of course, a lot of school stories as we're getting ready for everyone to go back to school in the next couple of weeks. And Nantucket schools are facing a shortage. They need teaching assistants.
They do. The first day of school here is less than 2 weeks away, and Superintendent Michael Kozort isn't exactly satisfied with the staffing levels right now. They're short teaching assistants in particular in a number of schools. Nantucket Elementary School and Nantucket Intermediate School have filled all of their positions, but Cyrus Pierce Middle School is short two teaching assistants, and the high school is short two teaching assistants. Cyrus Pierce is also short a Chinese teacher and a behavioral support specialist. So they're heading into the school year without a full complement of staff. And they say that the teaching assistants in particular provide support for classroom teachers across the board, but they're particularly vital to programs like special education and English language learning, of which there are increasingly more students on Nantucket, as well as dealing with students with behavioral issues. They're really attributing the inability to hire this year to this continued strong economy on the island, where people who might normally apply for these positions are finding better paying jobs. And on the flip side, the high cost of living and housing on the island, which is preventing them maybe from taking jobs at this salary level. But they're continuing to look, and they hope to fill at least some of these positions before school starts or immediately after.
Are they thinking that they're going to have to look off island and try to recruit folks in, or are they looking within the community? Do they have any idea about that?
They generally do both. They advertise wherever they can. Many of the positions are usually filled from on island because those people already have housing for the most part. They're also hoping that maybe some people who had been working summer jobs here may decide to stay if there are positions available, and we'll work through the fall and winter before going back to summer jobs again next year.
And that is Josh Balling, editor of the Nantucket Enquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for checking in and hanging on there with our technical difficulties. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too.
Now I want to go to stories from the Mid and Outer Cape, and that's with Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Catherine.
Thanks for joining us.
No, my pleasure.
I want to look at a story out of Chatham in the paper this week. The owners of a marina there have started a petition because they want some help with dredging, and this marina is at Outermost Harbor. Some of their boats get stuck. The bigger boats get stuck when there's low tide.
Sure. It's not just really the bigger boats. It's most of the boats that moor at this marina, which is just south of Lighthouse Beach. And this is kind of a story about the effects of Chatham's dynamic shoreline. It's for more than a year now, sand has really been moving south from Lighthouse and South Beach and clogging up the entrance channel to Outermost Harbor, where that marina is located. Now, they have about 90 slips, and they also serve a few hundred other boaters, transient boaters, over the course of the summer. And they even purchased their own dredge last year so they could clear out that channel, try to keep it clear. But they had to stop in the early spring because of state environmental restrictions on dredging, and right now the entrance channel is really only inches deep at low tide, and even at high tide, it's not very deep. A lot of boats can get through at high tide, so boaters find themselves having to play the tide. Some of them have moored their vessels in an outer area of the harbor where the town has allowed them to establish some temporary moorings. The marina, as you said, started an online petition to gather support. They're asking the town for help in expediting dredging permits, getting emergency priority placement on the Barnstable County dredges schedule, and they're also looking for some economic assistance from the town. Now, they say that's justified because the channel serves not just the marina and the surrounding neighborhood, but marina owner Harrison Kahn told us that the Coast Guard and the harbor master and fire departments use the harbor periodically when they need to, and they facilitate that. And they'd like, aside from some economic help from the town, they're looking for some regulatory relief from state requirements, such as having to have an engineer on site overseeing the dredging, which makes it more expensive for them to do this work. And they'd like to get on the county dredges priority list. And that's a little problematic, town officials say, because as we know and we've talked about in the past, the county dredging program has had some difficulties in the past year. Last year, a number of dredging projects didn't get done because of breakdowns of the two county dredges. Right now, those dredges are being worked on, and a third dredge is in process. But just in Chatham, Stage Harbor and Aunt Lydia's Cove were supposed to be dredged last year, and so those are two areas overdue for dredging. So town officials say they're not sure where in that order of things the outermost project would fall. And so they're planning, the town officials are planning to meet with the marina owners soon, and they hope to bring this matter before selectmen to try to see if they can resolve some of these issues and where they should be going. They've gathered about 330 signatures on their online petition, and they hope to keep their business going. You know, with all the sand moving in, it's just been very difficult for them over this current summer season.
Mm. Yeah, and it sounds like with that list for the county, that it's just this is probably not going to be resolved, maybe even until next year.
It may not be. I mean, it's a small harbor. It's doesn't have the same safety priorities as, say, Stage Harbor here in Chatham would have, or other harbors around the Cape. And they do have their own dredge, which they can use at least once the environmental restrictions that the state puts on dredging are lifted, which won't happen until the late fall and the winter.
Right, so there is some time to go. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, thanks so much for checking in. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. Bye now.
I want to take a look at news now from the Outer Cape, from Provincetown. I have Casey Myers on the phone from the Provincetown Banner. Thanks for joining us, Casey.
Sure. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good.
So, Provincetown Board of Health got an earful this week about a rat problem. We have rats all over the Cape. There's been talk about this before, but it sounds like it's getting particularly bad in Provincetown and some of the Outer Cape towns as well.
Well, yeah, this is the second week we've written about rats. The first week, our reporter Jessica Hill was following up on a tip that rats were on Pearl Street, which is a street in the central east end of Provincetown. And she talked to several people in the neighborhood who confirmed that, yes, rats were indeed part of the neighborhood. And we now have a photo to prove it, which is kind of creepy looking. But then she spoke with a Cape-wide pest control expert and a statewide expert who both said rats are an issue on the Cape and throughout the state, like you said.
Yeah.
And the population seems to be growing. That's the issue.
Yeah.
And there are many theories on why, including climate change. The rising sea level is flooding the marshes where the rats live. That's one theory. So this week, Jessica attended a meeting of the Board of Health where the town's Animal Welfare Committee had a pre-scheduled agenda previous to our article to talk about alternative techniques to controlling the rats. And their agenda is really they don't want the harmful use of those rodenticides, which are poison, which once the rats eat is then passed on to the raptors who eat the rats, and they can get very sick and die from it. But many people were also at this meeting to talk about the rat problem in general, and they were not from Pearl Street.
Right.
Charles Stormy Mayo. Yep.
We may know this name. Yep.
Yes, of course. He's a scientist and founder of the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies. He lives several blocks away from Pearl Street, and he said he's captured between 25 and 50 rats on his property.
Oh, my gosh. That's a lot of rats.
Yeah, and he uses the traditional snap rat traps, and then he's also been using fluorescent dye somehow to track their behavior.
I love that he's taking a scientific approach to this problem, I had to say when I read the article, that he's not just trying to rid the area, he's trying to figure out their behavior.
I know, exactly. And he's done pretty well. I mean, he says that the rats are very intelligent, and the only ones he's been able to capture are the immature ones, which are not yet breeding. Speaking of breeding, female rats under ideal conditions produce 8 to 12 pups a month.
Wow.
And
that's
prolific. So it is. And one expert told us, if things get out of control, it's really hard to pull it back.
Yeah. And so there's been talk about not just trapping and kind of getting rid of rats, but also using birth control for rats to stem the population growth.
Yes, which has been approved by the FDA, apparently, and that's one option. But nobody's made any decisions about that because they're concerned about what that will do up the food chain, if there's any other biohazards with that.
Yeah, there could be a real ripple effect, and that's something to carefully consider before taking action.
Yes, exactly. And a best preventative measure is to do things that nobody's going to want to do, which is get rid of their bird feeders, get rid of the compost heaps, get up really early in the morning rather than leave the trash out overnight for the garbage collectors. And, you know, so these are some real losses to people. So,
yeah.
You know, this will take action.
Human behavioral changes to try to change the behavior of rats. Casey Myers, thanks so much for bringing us this story from the Provincetown Banner. I'm sure folks in other towns can sympathize and empathize with those dealing with rats down in Provincetown.
Thank you very much for your time.
I want to go back now to Martha's Vineyard and talk with Brittany Bowker of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brittany.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Brittany, we just have a moment or two. I want to focus on a story in the paper this week, and it's about how lead contamination in Coast Guard housing out in West Chop has led to a much broader investigation of other types of Coast Guard housing around the country.
Yeah, so this story is pretty interesting. About a year ago, two chief officers with Station Menemsha Coast Guard and their families vacated housing on West Chop in Vineyard Haven after learning about potential lead paint dangers on the property. And after testing, two children tested positive for lead exposure, and it sparked a nationwide initiative for vetting Coast Guard housing. And the Safe Homes, it's called the Safe Homes Initiative, and it launched last month. And it's a service-wide effort to ensure all Coast Guard housing are free of environmental housing or environmental hazards, especially lead. And lead paint is a neurotoxin. It's infamous for harming children's developing brains. It wasn't banned in the country until 1978. So the initiative is focused on some of the older homes that the Coast Guard uses for housing that predates 1978. And so far, 67 houses of more than 2,000 have been identified for further testing.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a fair number of homes considering how many Coast Guard members have their families with them, and that includes children who could be exposed to lead paint.
Right, and they're the ones that could be most affected by it. So it's an important initiative, and hats off to our reporter, Rich Salzberg, who's been covering the story, because it's led to something bigger that's going to assist the quality of public health across many communities.
And with the Coast Guard housing on the vineyard there, those families were moved, and I read that now the Coast Guard is considering rehabbing the actual houses that they had to get people out of because of the fact that it's tough to find housing in general on the vineyard. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, housing is a huge issue here. There's a housing crisis on the island. So whenever there is an opportunity to mitigate the health detriments on a property, they're gonna try as best they can to remedy these homes so that they can be livable again. But of course, they have to take all of the necessary precautions and do their due diligence so that people aren't being exposed to lead in these older homes.
And that is Brittany Bowker of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brittany, thanks so much for checking in and bringing us this update on this story. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks.
And we have to take a break, but we have more regional stories to bring you coming up. Stay with us.
Well, there's one that I put down here that was really quite amazing. It was a young guy who showed up here from Cleveland, and he rode in on a motorcycle and came in and took his jacket off, and which I did with anybody that I saw that has tattoos. I asked him if they have any Edward Gorey tattoos, so I saw him come into the museum, and I said, "Do you by chance have any?" And it stopped me in my tracks when I saw what he had on his arm.
Rick Jones, curator of the Edward Gorey House in Yarmouthport.
It's Edward with glasses and a white beard and bats and children completely covering both arms. And I asked him, you know, if he had driven the motorcycle all the way from Cleveland. He said, yes, he'd left that morning. I said, when are you going back? And he said, about a half hour after you close. He spent the day here and then was going back. And he said he'd get back by midnight or 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. He did get back, I know, because he sent us better quality pictures of the tattoos.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
Welcome back to our local news roundup right here on WCAI. I'm Catherine Ident in for Steve Junker. I want to take a look at State House news from Beacon Hill. We had a lot of news this summer about transportation, some of it good, some of it not so good. I talked with WCAI's State House reporter Mike Dean about why there happens to be so much news about roads, bridge, tunnels, and driving in the summer months. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. I hope no one's actually stuck in traffic listening to this. It's going to hurt.
Yeah, we've got some good and some bad. Let's talk first about some bad, and that is an update on the RMV investigation, Registry of Motor Vehicles. This investigation started after it came to light that thousands of Massachusetts drivers should have lost their licenses, but didn't because the RMV was not processing notices of driving infractions. And now somebody has lost their job.
Yeah, Tom Bowes, the head of the Merit Rating Board. In 2016, they were assigned the backlog of physical alerts from other states that about criminal convictions and driving violations and things like that that Massachusetts drivers committed in other states. And their job was to process that backlog. This is the backup system to the electronic alert system that most license suspensions kind of arrive from. What happened was that electronic system screwed up. This backlog only got larger and larger and larger. That Merit Rating Board staff wasn't keeping up with it. And then we had a tragedy like we saw in New Hampshire with the seven motorcyclists who were killed by someone allegedly who should have had his license revoked. Many people are saying that Bowes is a scapegoat. That's certainly what his attorneys say. Some folks up on Beacon Hill say that the problems at the RMV run much, much deeper than that. If you remember, Registrar Aaron Divney also resigned almost immediately after this news broke in June about this. And so now these investigations are showing kind of where the failures were. Baker administration officials say that his removal, his firing, is to get new leadership in there that can do the job properly, not necessarily a punitive role in what has already happened.
Can you explain what the Merit Board does exactly?
The Merit Board's main task is to keep track of different, license suspensions, violations, accidents, things like that, and alert insurance companies. So the Merit Board is kind of the conduit between your fender bender and the insurance company knowing about your fender bender so that, your rates are adjusted accordingly. They were given this backlog of processing on a staff level because they had experience processing driver's records. That's how they ended up with this jurisdiction to begin with. And that is the staff that Bowes was the head of up until recently. Bowes, it should be mentioned, is actually running for mayor of Braintree. He's a city councilor in that city, and he was trying to succeed Mayor Sullivan, who is not running again. So that's an interesting wrinkle, that the fact this guy who just got fired is defending himself as a scapegoat and still going to be on the ticket for mayor.
All right, so it's not really the last the public has seen of him.
Correct.
Do you think there'll be other firings or personnel changes at the RMV because of these investigations?
Firings, it remains to be seen. There's not too many higher officials that kind of have culpability anymore about this because the registrar is gone and because the head of the Merit Rating Board is now gone. But you definitely will see personnel changes because I believe they're probably going to staff up. If part of this dysfunction was a lack of staff and a lack of manpower, then yes, you will probably see a number of more professionalized folks from the Baker administration heading into the RMV to clean it up.
And I wanted to ask now, why so much news this summer about transportation systems? Of course, the RMV, that is a special story born out of tragedy, but there's been so many other stories. And of course, there's been a lot of problems with the MBTA. And we've been talking even about trains down here with talk of the commuter rail and other transportation related issues. So what's going on there?
Yeah, it's, you know, roads, trains, tunnels, and, you know, ferries. Like a week or two ago, that MBTA commuter ferry ran aground because it was going to hit another craft. So it ran aground instead. So it seems like there's a problem with every kind of, you know, every mode of transportation one way or another. We had that giant congestion report that the Baker administration put out. Transportation is going to be a big issue every summer because, you know, people are traveling. It's just, something that's on people's minds, and these extreme examples of transportation failures become flashpoints when really the summer was supposed to be kind of positive on the transportation side because new MBTA subway cars are finally going into use on the Orange Line and then on the Red Line later on next year. It was supposed to be a good news summer, but as we've seen from derailments and congestion and everything, it's getting almost impossible to move around Eastern Mass.
That's right. And I'm sure there'll be more discussion about it when legislators return from their August break. They are on recess right now. And also this week, Mike, sort of transportation related, folks who buy electric cars will not be able to get a state rebate after October 1st.
Yeah, that's right. The program that was giving $1,500 for the purchase of a new electric or fuel cell car is over as of October 1st. There's no money in the budget for that anymore. And a lot of that has to do with kind of plummeting sales of EVs. We saw a spike in sales when the last Tesla model came out, and then it's really dropped off. The market hasn't really kept up, so it was kind of on the chopping block. Some environmentalists want to see if there's another funding mechanism to bring that rebate back, but you have throughout the month of September to buy a car and net that $1,500.
And I've heard some criticism again from environmental activists saying that, you know, we have a host of green related laws here in Massachusetts and a push to cut carbon emissions and that this is taking a step backward.
Yeah, it's certainly people seem to see it that way. On the other hand, some environmentalists could think that putting that money towards other kinds of resiliency or solar or wind or whatever might make more sense, and that effectively this is reimbursing affluent people who are buying these electric cars to begin with. So it might maybe not be money well spent from the state's environmental agenda perspective.
And finally, Mike, in other news, we heard about an announcement this week from a developer who wants to put not exactly a full-blown casino, but a smaller type of a casino of sorts in Wareham. And he says he needs state lawmakers to change the law governing gambling in Massachusetts. How likely is that to happen?
It's kind of the next phase in this very long gaming saga that has been around since that 2011 law legalized casino gambling. If you remember, the state was broken up into three different regions, A, B, and C. A, Greater Boston, has the brand new Encore Resort Casino. Western Massachusetts, B, has the Springfield MGM Casino. It's been open for some time now. Region C, Southeastern Massachusetts, including the Cape, never got that resort casino license assigned to anybody. There were some attempts, but it just never happened. A lot of that has to do with whether or not Native tribes are going to be able to open one up in Taunton under federal authorization, not state control. So people have been holding their breath when it comes to this. This plan would be for a racino, so to speak. It would be a horse racing track.
Yeah, did you coin that term?
No, it's been around for a long time. We're talking about Suffolk Downs and things like that from years ago. This would be kind of a electronic gaming slots parlor type vibe attached to a racetrack in Wareham off of Route 25. So he would need not only access to Route 25 from where the site is, this developer would also need a change in the law to allow for something less than a full-blown resort casino to be built in Region C so that the Gaming Commission could authorize a project of this scale. He says that this is the right scale for the market as it stands right now, but opponents of this plan say that they're still holding out for that large-scale full-on resort casino down the line. And so it's not the most popular idea in the building right now. We'll remain to be seen whether or not the developer's lobbyists can convince enough lawmakers to tweak the law in his favor.
That's WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks for being with us this morning.
Always great to be with you.
I want to take a look now at a story that we've been covering closely now for a long time, and that's the story of the North Atlantic right whale. The right whale is critically endangered. There are only about 400 left in the world. And federal officials have been on a listening tour over the past few weeks or months, all throughout New England, from Maine, Rhode Island, and then into Massachusetts, where on Wednesday night, they talked to about 200 lobstermen, environmentalists, and stakeholders at Bourne High School. WCAI's Eve Zukoff joins me now. She went to that meeting and she heard firsthand from both sides of the argument to protect the whales, but also from fishermen who want to protect and need to protect their livelihoods. Thanks for joining me, Eve.
Thanks, Katie.
So tell us more about Wednesday's meeting and how those two groups got it to the same place.
Yes. So the meeting was hosted by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. They were calling it a scoping meeting, kind of a soft term, I think. And they did it because they, as you said, they feel like they need to really gather information from stakeholders like lobstermen and whale researchers before they expand their efforts to protect these whales. Because many of the conservation efforts could interfere with the fishing industry, so they wanted feedback on reduction measures, weak ropes that break when something really heavy, like a whale, pulls on them, gear marking requirements, and areas that are closed to fishing. That's kind of what environmentalists, lobstermen, seafood sellers, veterinarians all took their turns kind of testifying their thoughts, giving feedback on those things.
And, you know, as I kind of mentioned in the introduction here, there are two important agendas, and one is to protect the whales, but the other is a livelihood. So mm-hmm. was there tension? Could you feel tension there?
I would describe it as emotional, passionate at times, but really respectful. I mean, these are groups that are invested in working together. And lobstermen, especially in Massachusetts, compared to some other states in particular, have really done the lion's share work of being open to change. And they made the point also, though, you know, they explained that there's real financial hardship on the line for them. And on top of that, you know, the 8 whale deaths that have happened this year have all been in Canadian waters. So there's kind of this feeling of, you know, we're already doing a lot of work. We're already complying. Why should we have to make all of these additional gear changes that are costly, even dangerous sometimes in cases like reducing the number of traps per trawl, when we've been doing the right thing? They really make this really compelling point that their livelihood is on the line, and we can't forget about that in this conservation effort.
And how did the environmentalists in the room respond to these stories and these points that were being made by lobstermen?
Yeah, they absolutely expressed sympathy and gratitude for the work that lobstermen have already done. But they recognized, you know, as you said at the beginning of this, there are 400 North Atlantic whales left, right whales left. They're on the brink of extinction. And Sarah Sharp, a veterinarian with the International Fund to Protect Animal Welfare, just kind of drove home this point that the way they're dying, these whales are dying, is so traumatic, is so horrific. This is an issue we should all care about. You know, she says, these are some of the worst injuries I've seen in my career as a veterinarian.
And they're human caused.
Yeah, there have been 1,500 line entanglements, deaths in North Atlantic right whales since 1980. Meanwhile, there are 400 left, and you basically can't kill them unless humans do it. So it's really significant.
Mm. And this was the last of 8 public meetings on NOAA's list. Is that right?
That's right. So, you know, as you said, Maine, Rhode Island, some of them were more tense than others. And so with that in mind, with all of this feedback in mind, NOAA officials say they're going to add regulations to what they called the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Plan by drafting an environmental impact statement. That's expecting to drop mid-year 2020. So this is an issue that's going to continue to play out.
And we will be checking in on that report when it comes out. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again.
Yes, I look forward to it.
That's WCAI's Eve Zukoff. We are out of time. Thanks, Eve, for joining us this morning. I want to thank my other guests. Jeff Spillane of the Cape Cod Times, Brittany Bowker from the Martha's Vineyard Times, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner, Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. And I want to thank you for listening to the News Roundup right here on WCAI.